Lecture 16, Evil and Suffering, Biblical and Rabbinic.
Why do the righteous suffer and the wicked prosper? These questions have been at the heart of religious traditions and philosophical traditions for thousands and thousands of years. I want to make the disclaimer at the beginning of this two-part investigation into the nature of evil and suffering in Judaism that there is no answer. And by that, I mean there is no single answer to the question. The reason why I waited to introduce the discussion of evil and suffering until this point in the lecture is so that we could map our discussion on to developments within medieval Judaism and then bring it up to the present in terms of modern Jewish responses, specifically modern Jewish responses to the Shoah or to what is also called the Holocaust. The first lecture in this two-lecture series is going to focus on biblical and rabbinic responses to evil and suffering. There are a variety of responses within the biblical literature itself. So let's begin by taking a look at individual and communal responsibility on the horizontal plane. What do I mean by the horizontal plane? That the individual, any individual, is located within a community. Judaism is a religion that is part and parcel of a whole Jewish civilization or Judean civilization or Israelite civilization. And so to separate the religion from its cultural national roots that we see in the Bible somehow distorts the religiosity that is presented in the Hebrew Bible. So first, let's begin there. There are no rewards for the individual who follows specific laws of the Torah. No such thing as an individual reward. There's a collective reward, and that is the people Israel will live long in the land of Israel, and that redounds to the benefit of each and every person. In contrast, there are punishments for individuals who transgress the laws, but the punishment can also extend to the entire community. For instance, as I mentioned a few lectures ago, when Israel disobeys God's will, there will be drought and famine. I'm now reading from Deuteronomy 11, verses 13 through 17. If then you obey the commandments that I enjoin upon you this day, loving the Lord your God and serving him with all your heart and soul, I will grant the rain for your land in its season. Take care not to be lured away to serve other gods and bow to them, for the Lord's anger will flare up against you, and he will shut up the skies so there will be no rain, and you will soon perish from the good land that the Lord is assigning to you. In other words, the communal punishment is exile. Exile is a motif of the Hebrew Bible. Adam and Eve are exiled from the Garden of Eden. The Jewish people are exiled from the land of Israel. This process of exile and return, redemption, right, is a leitmotif of the Hebrew Bible. Getting back to the land which represents salvation, represents redemption in the biblical mindset. In the rabbinic period, some rabbis argued that Jerusalem and the temple were destroyed because certain communal leaders acted with sinat chinam. Sinat chinam, I think, is best translated as gratuitous nastiness, right? Being nasty for no good reason. And the story that's told in Tractate Gittin is of a party, of a banquet. And the host of the party sends out a series of invitations, and the messenger actually makes a mistake, and instead of sending it to John Doe, sends the invitation to Doe John, or Don Jones, that's better, Don Jones, okay? And when Don Jones gets the invitation, he's very surprised because he knows the host, and they don't get along too well. So he's wondering why the host invited him after all. Well, when Don Jones shows up to the banquet, the host doesn't understand what's happened, and orders his servants to kick Don Jones out of the party. Well, that's not very nice, and it would humiliate Don Jones. So Don Jones negotiates with the host and says, look, let's not embarrass me. I'll stay for just a little while. I'll pay for what I eat. Just, you know, don't throw me out. Well, this host, who happens to be a rabbi, doesn't take no for an answer and kicks Don Jones out. Well, Don Jones is upset and seeks revenge. And through an interesting combination of events, he manages to get the rabbinic host and the friends of the host, the other rabbis of the time, to refuse to accept an offering from the Roman government because there is a flaw in the animal that the Romans give the host to be sacrificed. The Romans are insulted by this, and this, according to the Talmud, kicks off the war between the Romans and the Jews, the Great Revolt from the year 66 to 70, that culminated in the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. The end of the story is less important than the beginning of the story. The rabbis are saying here that it's not anything that could have been, that was destined or fated. It was the individual actions of these rabbis as a result of sinat chinam, gratuitous nastiness, that led to the events that the temple was destroyed as well as Jerusalem. People ask, where was God on September 11th, 2001? If we ask that same question about the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, where was God? God doesn't appear in the story. In other words, one of the events that is as central to the rabbinic religion and to the rabbinic mindset as the destruction of the temple, the story that presents that destruction doesn't feature God as a player. It's all about how human beings inflict wounds on themselves through senseless hatred or gratuitous nastiness that culminate in these communal catastrophes. Okay. That's one kind of evil, an evil that's visited upon an entire generation, the horizontal plane. But there's also a kind of evil or suffering that the Bible describes as being visited upon not a generation, but intergenerationally or vertically, if I can use that image. So let's go to the Decalogue for an example of that kind of punishment. I'm reading from Exodus chapter 20, verses 5 and 6. For I, the Lord your God, am an impassioned God, visiting the guilt of the parents upon the children, upon the third and upon the fourth generations of those who reject me, but showing kindness to the thousandth generation of those who love me and keep my commandments. So you see that there's a lack of symmetry between the punishing side and the rewarding side. The punishment only happens for three or four generations, but the love and kindness, that continues on for 1,000 generations. That kind of theology, where the children inherit, or where the children are visited by God as a result of the sins of the parents and grandparents and great-grandparents, didn't survive the Hebrew Bible uncontested. Already in the book of Deuteronomy and then in the prophets, in Ezekiel, there's a rejection of that kind of theology. Each person is held accountable only for his or her own actions, not for what happened, not for what somebody else in the community did, and certainly not for what their great-grandmother did. So we see different voices trying to grapple and trying to understand with why evil happens. And in the process of that grappling, some of the theodicies, I'll explain that word in a second, some of the theodicies that are presented are explicitly rejected already within the biblical literature. Okay, what is a theodicy? Theo, God, dis, like judicial. Theodicy means justifying God's ways. If we want to hold on to, and most of us do want to hold on to, God's goodness and God's power, how can we explain the existence of evil in the world? Maybe God's not all good, or maybe God's not all powerful. But if we want to hold on to those two things, then what can we offer as an explanation of the evil that seems to be ever present before our eyes? There's one other kind of explanation for evil that doesn't involve a kind of communal suffering or an intergenerational suffering, but I'm calling an eschatological explanation. Eschatology means the end of days or the next world, the afterlife. This is what I'm referring to. So not in the Bible, but in the rabbinic period, notions of heaven and hell were used to explain why the righteous suffer in this world and why the wicked prosper. The righteous are punished. They're punished here for the very few bad deeds that they commit, right? No one is totally righteous. So they must have done some small peccadillo, some small transgression. So let them be punished in this world so that they can be rewarded in the world that is eternally long, in the world to come. Right. Similarly, the wicked are rewarded here for that one old lady that they helped cross the street. But they'll be punished for the rest of their wicked deeds in a world that is very, very long. In this kind of theodicy, there's simply... In another version of the eschatological explanation, there's simply no connection between what happens in this world and our behavior. Things happen in this world by chance, by circumstance, by God. We don't know. But it's only in the afterlife that we will get our comeuppance. We'll either be rewarded for our good deeds or we will suffer for our misdeeds. Perhaps the most common theodicy in the Hebrew Bible, what I would call the normative theodicy of the Hebrew Bible, is that this world makes sense and that good things happen to good people and bad things happen to bad people. Psalm 62 says this very nicely. God rewards each person according to his deeds. Now, this theology or this theodicy is enshrined in the Jewish liturgy. So for the holidays, we read in the Jewish prayer book, we were exiled from our land because of our sins. In other words, we sinned, and as a response, we were exiled. Notice this is a different theodicy than the story that I explained about the host who invited the wrong person, Don Jones, right? God wasn't involved in that story explicitly. But rabbinic theology is comforted, and indeed I think it is comforting to think, that all of our actions have an equal and appropriate reaction by God. And so the righteous are rewarded and the wicked are punished. So if there was a punishment in the form of the exile from the land of Israel, then that must mean that the Jews transgressed, the Jews sinned. Often the specific reward or punishment that we receive is identifiably related to the deed. This is called measure for measure, right? This was an idea of the rabbis even before Shakespeare got a hold of it. So let me give you an example of measure for measure. Samson was very vain about, Absalom was very vain about his hair, and he had a long mane of hair, biblical character, and so he was hanged by his hair. Samson was led astray by his eyes, by being seduced by Delilah, and so his punishment was his eyes being gouged out. The Egyptians lost all of their males in the last plague and in the Sea of Reeds. Why? Because they had sought to kill all of the Israelite males by throwing them in the Nile. So that action which one commits influences the reward or punishment that one receives. That's called measure for measure. And although the term measure for measure isn't spelled out in the Bible, the rabbis use the term midah keneged midah, measure for measure, as a way of understanding what happens in the Hebrew Bible as well as in our world. Sometimes it can have a very nice exegetical results as well. There is a particular story at the very beginning of Exodus that involves Shifra and Puah, two Hebrew midwives. We're not sure if they're midwives of the Hebrews, in other words, Egyptian midwives of the Hebrews, or if they're actually Israelite midwives. Their names are Shifer and Pua, and there's a midwifery society in Israel called the Shifer and Pua Society. They disobeyed the Pharaoh's command to throw all of the male children into the Nile, and the text says they were rewarded with houses. God rewarded them with houses. So, okay, what does that mean that they were rewarded with houses? Does it mean that God, as a carpenter, built them sort of row houses or a nice development in a better neighborhood? Or is the word house being used here like the house of Shifra and the house of Pua and the house of David as a metaphor for their family? Well, it must be used as a metaphor for the entire family if we have an understanding that the Bible works in this kind of measure-for-measure way. Shifra and Pua saved the children of the Israelites, and so they were rewarded, they were blessed with having children of their own. So God blessed them by providing a home, not in terms of a physical structure, but in terms of children. This theology of measure for measure and of everyone receiving what they deserve is sometimes harsh. We go back to the example of the Jews being exiled from the land for their sins. So some contemporary psychologists might say, isn't this an example of blaming the victim? Maybe it all had to do with Romans and power politics and didn't have anything to do, historically, with Jewish actions. And historically, that may or may not be the case. We imagine that there was certainly Jewish involvement in the revolt that led to the exile and the destruction of the temple. But on a spiritual level, what this kind of theology does is to promote introspection. It's empowering, in a way, to blame the victim, because it means that the victim, in the future, can do something differently to change his fate or her fate, so that no longer am I destined or fated to be exiled from Spain in 1492 or whatever the negative consequence might be. But if we understand that we get back what we put out, then it's going to make us extra conscientious to put out into the world good things and blessings and behaving nicely, because for those people that need that kind of extrinsic reward system, they will imagine that as a result of their good deeds and good actions, they will be appropriately and proportionately compensated by God for their actions. So although historically we were exiled for our sins, perhaps in the future we will be blessed and we will be restored for our good deeds. Now that's an example of the world making sense. Already in the Bible, perhaps one of the most famous books of the Tanakh, describes a world that doesn't make sense. At least it doesn't make sense to the creatures of the world. And of course, I'm referring to the book of Job. Job is a righteous man, and yet he has all kinds of calamities and catastrophes visited upon him to test his faith. And at the end of the book, a voice resounds out of the whirlwind and says the following. God speaks to Job. I'm in chapter 39, verses 26 to 28. Is it by your wisdom that the hawk grows pinions, spreads his wings to the south? Does the eagle soar at your command, building his high nest, dwelling in the rock? In other words, there is a logic and a rationale to the way the world works, but you are merely a finite creature with no chance of being able to comprehend the depths of wisdom that was involved in my creation. And so rather than being so, here I'll use the word a little differently, anthropocentric and thinking that you're at the center of the universe, understand your place as a cog, not in a machine, but a cog in the divine drama. God is still in charge in this Jobian model, but God's justice and God's goodness are not transparent to human beings. The rabbis develop that thought into something far more unsettling. I've already mentioned this theodicy when I touched on eschatological explanations. In the Talmud, we have Rabbi Jacob, saying that there is no reward for commandments in this world. It's a simple enough line, but what it means is that this world doesn't make sense. There is no connection in this world between what we do and what we get. Everything awaits the afterlife for Rabbi Yaakov. Now, this is a little different than Job. Job is saying the world makes sense to God, it's only you that can't figure it out. This might be saying, this at a minimum says, no, the world doesn't make sense. But it might even be saying the world doesn't make sense even to God. Even to God, this world operates, the world that God created operates in such a way that things that shouldn't be happen. As a result of giving God's creatures free will, we do things that God disapproves of. But God pulls back and restrains God's self from intervening because the price of intervention would come at the cost of the free will of human beings, of God's creatures. And God is unwilling to pay that price. This set of explanations or theodicies for evil and suffering is not exhaustive, nor is it sufficient. And you can see that there's a multiplicity of responses that might fit different occasions of evil, that might fit different personalities or temperaments in terms of how they respond to evil, or they might best reflect how someone sees evil as a young man, or as a mature adult, or as an elderly sage. Judaism doesn't force anyone to see the presence of evil in the world in a certain way. It offers a variety of explanations for a condition that seems to be inevitable. Why do I say that it seems to be inevitable? In those first chapters of Genesis, from Genesis 1 to Genesis 11, primeval history, as Professor Levine called it in her The Teaching Company's Introduction to the Old Testament series, you've got the story of Cain and Abel, which we mentioned already. Cain and Abel is a very disturbing story because Cain offers the first sacrifice. That sacrifice isn't accepted. Abel plays copycat with his brother, offers a sacrifice. Cain's isn't described as being nearly of the same quality as Abel's sacrifice. Cain's sacrifice, therefore, seemingly, is not accepted. So what would you expect? You would expect that God's favor would shine upon Abel and God would punish Cain. That's what you would expect. But what happens? Cain kills Abel in a jealous rage, and Cain gets away with murder. So even though God had accepted Abel's sacrifice, that acceptance didn't afford Abel any kind of divine protection. More troublingly, not only does Cain get away with murder, he's protected by God. Cain complains to God and says, look, anybody who sees me is gonna kill me. You need to give me some form of protection so that, right, if you're not going to kill me, that nobody else is going to kill me either. So Cain gets away with murder, and God gives him some kind of a mark or some kind of a sign. It's not a stigma. Go back and read Genesis chapter 4. It's a sign of protection, that anyone who kills Cain will be avenged sevenfold. How can this be? How can Cain get away with murder and receive a kind of divine sanction and protection, and Hevel, who was favored by God, be killed? This bothered the early interpreters, the Christian fathers and the rabbis of the Talmud and the Midrash. The only way the rabbis of the Talmud could reconcile what they were reading is to say, oh, we have an easy explanation for this. It must be that after Cain's murder of his brother Abel, Cain did teshuvah. Cain repented. And that's why God didn't kill him, and that's why God protected him. Does the text say that Cain did teshuvah? Not exactly, but both the church fathers who have this understanding and the rabbis of the Midrash who have this understanding read the text in such a way, in such a Midrashic fashion, in order to have some kind of explanation for why Cain wasn't killed as punishment for having murdered his brother. Fast forward 2,000 years. Elie Wiesel. Elie Wiesel, in an examination of this story, says the following. Perhaps God wanted to show us, the readers, or Cain and Abel, already at the very beginning of history, that history is inevitably unjust. And so we have this story to demonstrate the lack of justice in this world. Elie Wiesel is a figure who has survived the horrors of Auschwitz, and perhaps he is more finely attuned to injustice than some others. But nevertheless, we have this continuing interpretation and reinterpretation of the biblical text, whereby this very troubling story of Cain and Abel, which I don't imagine troubled you quite as much before I presented at least one reading of the text, but it bothered some of the interpreters. And so whether you're willing to add a conversation or an event in the middle of the text, like, oh, well, Cain must have done teshuvah, Cain must have repented for his deeds, or to take the approach that Elie Wiesel took and say, no, we're going to leave the text as it is. It's coming to teach a different lesson about the inherent injustice in a world that is blessed with human free will. No matter which approach you take, somehow you have to deal with the existence of evil. So what we've done in the first session is to chart out different ways that the Bible and the rabbis grappled with the inevitability of evil. And as we move into the second lecture on evil, we'll take a look at how the philosophers and the mystics of the Middle Ages dealt with that question, as well as have a discussion of the Holocaust, the Shoah, and different Jewish responses to the Shoah.